Rick Cogan. That's the banjo of Michael Miles. He and I will be doing another one of our shows at the Hideout this Tuesday at 6:30, devoted to the American automobile. You can go to hideoutchicago.com to get details. You'll be hearing his astonishing playing all through the show, but it's now my pleasure to welcome Patricia Bolton Stratton. I have talked to her on the phone when I did a story a couple weeks ago about the day Picasso came to town. Is that a way to put it, Patricia? Your book is magnificent. It's called The Chicago Picasso, A Point of Departure. It, in essence, this book is almost 50 years in the writing, is it not?
Well, I interviewed people that were on the scene, and then they talked about what had happened before
beforehand.
That. So actually, it started in 1963 when the Chicago architects first visited Picasso.
You, sadly, 50 years ago on Tuesday, couldn't make it. You were only a couple blocks away, and you couldn't get out for lunch to join me, the young Rick Cogan, and 4,000 or 5,000 other people who were in the plaza for that event.
Now, I was working at a bank at LaSalle and Washington, and every day when I was going to and from work on and crossing the plaza or along the street,
sure,
because the plaza was blocked off now with this construction around the Picasso so we couldn't see it, but I would be going to take the bus home or taking the bus down in the morning. And so nobody saw it, but I had a brand new job at the bank. I was a computer programmer working on a savings account,
when computers were as big as rooms, right?
Right. Maybe not quite as big as the Picasso, but large, and I couldn't get out.
What was your personal level of curiosity about what was going on with the Picasso? You knew Picasso had been commissioned to do a sculpture for the city of Chicago, I guess, as most people working in the loop did. How curious were you? How curious and how excited were you?
I don't think I felt that excitement. I had just started back to get an MBA at night at Northwestern. I had been a business undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
So that, the number side of my brain was active.
Sure.
I was getting married,
mm-hmm,
that fall.
Yeah, you were distracted by the real world.
The real world. So I didn't have time to think about the art part and what was happening. Of course, I'd heard of Picasso, but I wasn't an art historian then. I didn't go back to school on my own. Until later in art history. I was working on an MBA. So it was a different side of the brain had not kicked in.
Do you remember, however, when you first, after the unveiling on August 15th of 1967, when you first did see it? I don't know if it was on your way home. Do you remember? I know this is a tough question. Do you remember your initial reaction?
The size of it.
Yeah.
It was absolutely huge. The building behind it we had seen.
Sure.
And I knew it was Corten Steel because my husband-to-be worked for Bethlehem Steel, and they were the only other company other than U.S. Steel that made weathering steel. So I was familiar with the material. This was a little different color because it had not had the patina develop.
Yeah. It didn't,
so it stood out from the building, but it was the size. I mean, there was this big structure erected in the plaza, but you didn't think all of that was going to be a sculpture behind there.
Right.
I thought it would be smaller.
Right. Do you remember liking it or not liking it, or your sort of visceral reaction to it rather than just the... And it was. I mean, it was immense. I mean, when they unveiled
it. There were people all over.
Yeah.
You know, so you couldn't really reflect upon it. You couldn't stand there and look at it because there were... The whole plaza was still filled with people, even at 5 o'clock when I was going home.
Yeah.
So it wasn't mine to enjoy and discover on my own yet.
When you decided, after getting married and getting, I suppose, tired of the business world, when you did decide to go back to school, what compelled you to go back to school to get a degree in art?
Well, I... became interested in what I had seen when I'd gone to Europe a couple of times. We went to museums. We went to cathedrals. And I thought, I don't know anything about this. I have to learn. And I became a docent at several museums, one in Davenport, Iowa. It's now the Figge Museum. And they have they gave the museum in Naples, Florida, where I go in the winter. I was a docent at the Milwaukee Art Museum. I wanted to learn, and I also took some classes when we were transferred to Moline, Illinois.
What kind of classes? They had art classes in Moline?
They did at their little colleges.
I'm glad to hear that.
They did, and I went to Augustana and took some classes. And the John Deere headquarters are there, and it was the headquarters building was made of Corten steel. So even way, and that was the first architectural use of the material. But it's in a wooded, grassy area, and it's a very horizontal building park-like, you know, verdant environment. So much different than having this Corten steel building than in Chicago coming out of a three-acre granite plaza.
Yeah.
So the contrast was different, but that's how I became acquainted first with the material and then started getting interested in being a docent and learning more about art and art history. And eventually I went back to Northwestern and got a master's in art history.
I know you have kids. Was this after the kids had grown or been out of your, when they were kind of out of your hair as
Not
little kids?
Not really. I had a preschooler when I went back to
You went back to school with a preschooler?
Just had one little girl. And
did you lock her in a closet? What did you do?
No. Of course not. But she did go to Montessori Nursery School in Evanston. Mm-hmm. And I lived in Wilmette. And so I could drop her off at Montessori.
I found it when we talked a few weeks ago, too. That is, it is wonderfully ambitious of you to undertake a degree, a postgraduate degree. I think it's wonderful. It was, you were so compelled by your experiences, you know, sort of almost tourist-like experiences with art. That you, it must have fired an immense kind of passion in you.
Well, I had to learn it. I was an only child. My mother wanted me to be perfect, so here I came across something I knew nothing about, and I had to learn about it.
That's a big commitment. I'm spending this entire hour with Patricia Bolton Stratton, whose book, "The Chicago Picasso: A Point of Departure," is not only the definitive story of that. A statue of which I'm increasingly fond and have grown increasingly fond over the years. It sits in what is now Daley Plaza, which was then Civic Center Plaza. She is going to be appearing with some other luminaries at 6 o'clock at the Harold Washington Library, that being the date of the anniversary of the unveiling of the Picasso 50 years ago. I was there. Mike Royko was legendarily there. There were thousands of others there. Among them, Studs Terkel and Lise Graham has pulled some excerpts from. Studs went there with a huge tape recorder, and you, Patricia, who were two blocks away, didn't do it. So we're going to play some of the excerpts of Studs, asking people what they thought of it. We have to take a break now, but you're spending the whole hour here. I hope you're comfy and
glad to be here.
Well, let's say that I think it's a very welcome addition to Chicago. I recognize Mr. Picasso as the outstanding artist in the world. I want to accept him as good faith. There are people who say that we are being spoofed. As a lawyer, though, I would venture another remark. But we have a doctrine called the attractive nuisance doctrine, which excuses what would otherwise be contributory negligence on the part of the person who's hurt, you know? Now, if you look at that thing and you realize the height of the slope on top and the propensity of children who will play on it, and it will not be guarded, I have, and I hope not, that some child may fall, you see, and be hurt, and the county may be sued, and under the present trend, there's no longer governmental immunity. Then we'll have a new doctrine, the doctrine of unattractive nuisance.
But I think it is. I think it's a politician that's got so many faces, don't you?
We who are here and the untold millions who will come to see it from the Middle West, the nation, and the world will behold it in the light of individual understanding and appreciation. The opportunity to be selective, the unlimited freedom of choice in every aspect of living. This is the great advantage of urban life.
That was Richard J. Daley on August 15th, 1967, at the unveiling of the Picasso. And a couple of other people giving their comments. Don't you love Patricia Stratton, the one who says, it's got to be a politician. It's got so many faces.
But that is really what Picasso was doing. I mean, this was his major breakthrough in the art world was cubism. And cubism is showing many different points of view at the same time.
Absolutely.
So it has more than one face.
Absolutely. And that... Well, you know more about, I would argue, the Picasso than anybody. You have studied it. This began as when you were back in art school and were following you through your whole career from these strange early days of computers to banking and business. And you're back at Northwestern getting a master's in art. And you decide you have to pick a thesis, a topic for a thesis. How did did you toss around any other ideas or immediately just say, I want the Picasso?
Well, I brought it up to my advisor, Dr. David Van Zanten, who mm-hmm. will be there on Tuesday on the panel.
Oh, great.
World-renowned architectural historian. And I said, I would like to do my thesis on the three major sculptures on Dearborn. That was the Flamingo by Calder, the Chagall at the First National Bank, and the Picasso. And he said, oh, way too much to cover in a thesis. You have to choose one. And it was easy to select Picasso over the other two.
Well, one reason, and you make such a great point in your book, The Chicago Picasso, A Point of Departure, that putting the Picasso in what was in Civic Center Plaza, this sort of spurred and sparked the whole notion of public art, which we kind of now take for granted. Did it not?
Absolutely. People used to think of public art would be the man on horseback.
Yeah,
in
the statue
park.
Of an old general.
A general or a politician.
Yeah.
They didn't think of anything this scale. That was new. And this was not totally abstract because you can still see those eyes and the nose. So you know it's a creature of some
sort. A creature of some sort, yes.
Of some sort,
yes.
Whether you think it's a person or a woman, but you know it's definitely.
A space alien or, well, everything's been mentioned when you mentioned
that's
the
Picasso.
That's true. Yes.
But it was new, it was different, and the scale. And it was before there was a percent for art program for all buildings, whether they were civic buildings or commercial buildings. That became part of what had to be in their budgets. But this was before then. The architects realized when you were building these tall Mesian buildings where there was no decoration, you could see the structure in the building, they were severe.
Sure.
And they were tall.
And they were icy. They were icy.
They were cold.
Yeah.
And then you had the Civic Center was sitting on this 3-acre granite plaza.
It was awful.
That was cold.
It was awful.
They had the little fountain
over
on the side, and that became very popular. People gravitated to the fountain, and there were some trees there. But the rest of the plaza was empty. And the architects realized they needed something to bridge the gap between the pedestrian and this 648-foot-tall building.
Yeah. No.
And so they first thought about a Henry Moore sculpture. They talked to Moore about it, and he said, my works are not big enough. You need something larger. And, I mean, he was world-renowned.
Oh, no question. No
beautiful
question.
Bronze sculptures. And Chicago's lucky enough to have a couple of them. But he said, this isn't big enough. And so they went back to the drawing board and said, okay, these are the three architectural firms that Daley had appointed. We need to go for the best artist in the world, the most famous. We want to try Picasso.
Was that Daley's idea?
I don't know for sure.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I like to think it was, but I can't imagine he knew anything.
He didn't know
about
anything
Picasso.
About art.
About Picasso. I can't even imagine.
I think it was the architects.
Even though Picasso was, almost without argument, the most famous artist in the world at the time. Yes,
definitely. But yeah. I don't know if that would have been on Mayor Daley's radar.
I'm pretty sure it wouldn't have been on his radar. So you're going to be here the whole hour. Let's start the story of how this whole process then began. I suppose it was, and you detail it in your fine, fine book, The Chicago Picasso, A Point of Departure, which you'll be talking about Tuesday night at the Harold Washington Library with some other luminaries, including your former, the guy who set you straight, David Van Zanten, Fred Liu, a retired Skidmore Owings architect who worked on the original project, Lynn Warren, the curator of contemporary art at the Museum of Contemporary Art here, Richard Hunt, a legendarily fine, fine, great sculptor, and John McCarter, the former president of the Field Museum, doing the moderating. How did it? Someone wrote him a letter.
Well, as it turned out, there were three architectural firms that Daley appointed. C.F. Murphy, Lobel, Schlossman, Bennett and Dart, and Skidmore, Owings and Merrill. And as our friend, an art critic, Franz Schulz, said, and it's quoted in the book,
yes,
that was genius on Daley's part. He had three ethnic firms, one WASP, one Jewish, one Catholic.
Yep.
And
well,
as,
that was all part of Daley's genius to begin with when it came to anything. Yeah.
And he hired the best people, put it in their hands. And so, as it turned out, among the architectural firms, Bill Hartman of SOM kind of took the lead on this sculpture project. He was also on the board of the Art Institute at the time.
So he did know. Bill Hartman did know who Picasso was.
Of course.
Yes. Bill Hartman knew who Picasso was.
And so he went to the president of the Art Institute at the time, who then put him in touch with Sir Roland Penrose in London, who was one of the premier Picasso biographers. And Penrose said, well, I don't know if we can get to Picasso, but I'll present your materials. And it took a while.
Sure.
And then finally Picasso said, okay, bring them over. I'll talk to them. So that was in 1963 when the principal partners of all three firms went to meet with him in southern France.
What was I'm gonna take a break. We're gonna start the second portion of this with the meeting with Picasso. Do you think, Patricia Balton Stratton, that Picasso was flattered to even be asked, or was he challenged at all? I don't know what I imagine.
Well, of course, people were always clamoring for a piece of him.
Oh, sure.
And he would not accept a commission. He said that right
up. I know.
You know, because if I do a commission, he said, his hands were tied artistically.
He wanted
the freedom to do what he wanted, to develop his ideas. He didn't want to have to meet a deadline. And he said, you would be disappointed to the Chicagoans, because you have a deadline, and if I couldn't meet it, you would be in hot water. So he said, I don't do commissions, but I'll think about this.
That's fantastic. We will continue on after the news and figure out what this meeting was. Patricia will tell us what the meeting was like with Picasso. And it sounds, I don't care who these architects were and how knowledgeable they were, it still had to be pretty intimidating to go meet Picasso. It's Michael Miles. He and I will be appearing at the Hideout on Tuesday, therefore missing Patricia Balton Stratton's gathering at the Harold Washington Library, where she would be talking with other luminaries, she being the most luminous of these luminaries, about her book, The Chicago Picasso, A Point of Departure. It grew out of her master's thesis years ago at Northwestern University, and it is the definitive story, also told. You're a good writer, Patricia. You're a very good writer, told in a very compelling narrative. All you will ever need to know about that statue that stands in what is now Daly Plaza, at the heart of the Loop. We're talking about Daly getting the idea of putting a statue in the plaza yet to be named for him, and getting three architectural firms and just in a politically savvy move. And they went over and they met representatives of those firms, went over and met Picasso, and he said, in essence, sure, but I want absolute freedom. The amazing thing, which you point out, and I think amazed a lot of people in the story that I wrote a couple of weeks ago, no charge. I mean, Picasso was, if not the most famous artist at the time, also his works were the most expensive works available. Why did he not charge any money for this?
Well, he always wanted to do a monumental sculpture. And he had had a commission in the 1928 from the city of Paris to do a monument to Apollinaire, a famous French poet whom he knew.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with a sculpture that were really lines in space, metal tubing.
Mm-hmm.
And Paris did not like it. They wanted a bust.
Right.
And so that was his only chance at a commission. And monumentality, so that soured him on commissions, but he kept his interest in doing something monumental. So when the architects went in 1963, Picasso was 81.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he knew he was running out of time to do something on this monumental
sure.
scale, and they had taken with them models of all the buildings around
the plaza,
the block.
Right.
And they were all in white, and then the Civic Center was in that brownish color painted to look like the Corten steel.
Mm-hmm.
And so he could see the scale of this project, that it was going to be big. This was his chance for monumentality,
yeah.
and it may be his last chance. There had been a Scandinavian sculptor, Carl Nesjar,
mm-hmm.
who had come to him about doing some of his works in concrete and kind of engraving them and painting the lines, and they were bigger blow-ups of metal sculptures that he was doing that were 12 inches to, oh, maybe 24, 30 inches, and he would blow them up mm-hmm. into concrete. So Picasso agreed to a couple of those. But this was going to be much bigger, and it was going to be in metal, which is much more lasting.
What also terribly intrigues me about it's one of the great through lines of your book, I think, is that Picasso actually knew very little. He had never been to Chicago. He knew very little about the city. I don't think he did any kind of deep research about the city. Isn't that an intriguing element of this whole story to you, Patricia?
Well, it became Bill Hartman going after him, visiting over. Maybe every 3 or 4 months he would go back to France, and he would take all kinds of Chicago memorabilia. He took, back then you had, you know, CDs
right.
of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. He took a White Sox helmet. He took a Indian Sioux war bonnet.
Perfectly representative of
Chicago.
That's Chicago crazy
in the Midwest.
Yeah.
He took
to try to and in essence was Mr. Hartman, who comes off as an incredible hero in this book, I think.
I think so.
And a
too.
Really cool guy. Trying to inspire the world famous artist and trying to, again, the White Sox helmet, because they just won the World, they were in the World Series in 1959, so why not bring a White Sox helmet? And a baseball helmet is probably something Picasso had never seen in his life.
In fact, he said, why do you Americans name your teams after your stockings? I don't know if he had heard of the Red Sox, too, but he knew who the White Sox were, and he thought that was really quite ridiculous.
I think he, but and it, I get a sense in the book that, that these two men, Hartman and Picasso, wound up liking and admiring each other.
I think so very much.
Yeah.
Bill said it really changed his life, and he had a very successful life.
A very full life, yeah.
And he said dealing with someone like Picasso on a regular basis, even though they didn't, Bill didn't speak a lot of French, but some French, Picasso spoke almost no English.
Right.
But they communicated.
So they did, so at one point they decided, Picasso said in a model, said this is what I would like to build there. And these guys signed off on it, right?
Well, he gave them a choice of two models
yeah,
he had.
Yeah.
And Bill Hartman chose the one that was a little lighter, a little airier. And so Picasso said, fine, I think I like that one too. And Bill shipped it to SOM as quickly as he could before anything changed. And then when it came to Chicago, then Fred Lowe, who lived in Winnetka, and kids went to New Trier. They were walking distance. And Fred went to the basement of the Art Institute for a couple of weeks and did the drawings in great secrecy of this model. Its word is maquette in French.
Sure.
But it's the model. And he did the initial drawings by hand. You know, you didn't have all these computer things
that
could do
this. Oh, of
course,
right.
And then they set up a show for the trustees and some of the politicians. And then after all that fanfare, then the architects had to make another model, and they made one out of aluminum, but to include some of the engineering principles
yes,
that they needed.
Yes, and to see how they could fabricate the woman, creature, alien, whatever it is.
And they didn't know yet what the material was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it would still be bronze.
Yeah.
But bronze is so costly. And bronze at 50 feet high is, they didn't know what to do, but they knew this Corten steel that was used to make bridges, was used to make guardrails, was the material of this
building.
This could work. And so they only went to U.S. Steel that made the...
And said, we need...
We want this. And then they had to be tested for wind tunnels.
Sure.
So it passed a wind tunnel test up to 183 miles per hour.
Okay, that'll do.
But if you're putting something up that weighs 162 tons, you don't want it moving.
You certainly don't. You
it
certainly,
has to be
certainly
there.
Don't. How long, then, did it take from, I suppose Daly had to sign off and all the architects
each
had to
stage,
sign off?
Daly had to sign off.
I'll bet he did. You would love to know, and I'm not sure it's in the book, you would love to know. Well, he probably never said what his actual first impression was.
He was too politic to do that.
Yes, he was.
He was
lost to history. Oh, yeah, no question. So they build the thing. They build it there under wraps, and it is unwrapped on August 15th, 1967. We're going to hear just a little portion of Stud Circle, who was there with his tape recorder, getting people's first impressions. There are, though, Patricia Stratton, as you detail in the book, there were a number of people who knew exactly what it looked like, exactly who were working on the construction of it, who were visiting while they were fabricating the thing. But most people did not, a la this.
You don't like it.
I don't like it, I tell you
straight. You don't like the color either.
Not even the color. Why don't they put up something that people, when they look at it, get delighted looking at it?
They all laughed at the Eiffel Tower. Look at it.
The Eiffel Tower,
and that became beautiful and useful.
The Eiffel Tower, I saw it. I was there in Paris. I was in Paris and I saw the Eiffel Tower. Yeah. Looks like a tower. I like, my question is, what is this?
What do you think?
I don't know what to think. I don't know what to think. I am disappointed, very much disappointed.
I think it's representative of our times in which we are in a state of emerging into a new kind of era and evolving from an old era. And I can see the transition in this monumental piece of sculpture.
I think it's a freak.
Well, what kind of freak?
Huh?
What does it look like?
I don't know. He doesn't know himself. He said he didn't know. He was just making something up. That's all, with scrap metal. I think it's a piece of scrap metal that sells for $12 a ton.
I object to it, but not violently enough to start a riot over it or have it removed. But if they put it to a vote, I'd vote to have it removed.
Couldn't tell. Ugly looking. Ought to be taken down. Disgrace that the city even accepted it.
I think it's pretty nice, and Mayor Daley did a good job here, and I think he's the best mayor we've had in the city of Chicago.
What's that look like to you?
This is fantastic. Don't you like this, Patricia?
Oh, I love hearing
Patricia,
what the people had to say.
Yeah, I didn't hear much of this. Studs Terkel was there with one of his big tape recorder taking down first impressions of the Picasso statue that came to town for keeps on August 15th, 1967. Patricia, the author of a fascinating, fabulous book, The Chicago Picasso, A Point of Departure, will be at the Harold Washington Library. It's a free event with a lot of other luminaries, John McCarter, David Van Zanten, Lynn Warren, Fred Lowe, and Richard Hunt, a notable contemporary sculptor and a Chicago native, talking about this at 6 o'clock. It's free. Get there, and there will be books, too. This is the most reasonably priced, fine book. It's $25, which is crazy to me. It's beautifully illustrated, it's handsomely designed, and it is gloriously written. We'll come back after a short commercial break and talk a little bit more with Patricia before I let her go to rest up for this Tuesday celebration. We'll be right back. The greatest banjo player on the planet, Michael Miles. He and I will be at Hideout Tuesday night at 6:30. Go to hideoutchicago.com. I love doing shows with Michael, but if we weren't doing the show, I would be at the Harold Washington Library a little before 6 to make sure I could get a seat to hear my guest, Patricia Bolton Stratton, talking about her book, The Chicago Picasso, A Point of Departure, with some real luminaries, people who know what they're talking about. Fred Lowe, a retired Skidmore Owing Merrill architect who worked on the original project, Lynn Warren of the MCA, David Van Zanten, a PhD, and your former advisor for your thesis who made you focus on the Picasso. God, give him a hug for me, because this is one of my favorite books. Your book, The Chicago Picasso, A Point of Departure, is just, it is a masterpiece, and it is also the definitive book. Does it surprise you, Patricia, that this is the... It stunned me when we were talking a few weeks ago in advance of a story I wrote about you in the book, that this is literally the only book devoted exclusively to the making of this magnificent sculpture.
The sculpture was never treated as an art object.
I know.
It was, you know,
a curiosity.
It was.
Novelty, yeah.
The art critics would write a column, and then that would be filed.
Mm-hmm.
No one ever gathered everything. And so when I did my thesis, I gathered all their newspaper and magazine articles, but I interviewed the principal people involved.
You interviewed
the architects,
a ton of people.
The engineers, the politicians, and the art critics. So it was firsthand research, and it had never been brought together before.
Right, right. I think it's brilliant. The sculpture itself was made, actually, in Indiana, correct?
Yes, and at the American Bridge and Iron Division of U.S. Steelworks.
And brought in here and then put together.
Yeah, reassembled.
You would, yes, reassembled.
They brought it in pieces.
Yeah.
And then welded permanently.
How long did it take once they brought the pieces here to construct it?
They had fitted all the pieces in Gary.
Right.
So they knew it would work. And they brought it in and put it on the granite and had to use railroad ties to slide these heavy pieces in. And I would say it was less than 2 months to reassemble it.
Wow. Were you, you've heard millions of opinions of what it is, what it looks like. I have ever thought it looks like a woman. I am in the majority because over the years, you have a wonderful thing you said to me that I'm going to quote. You wrote it in a book. It says you believe the debate, whatever the debate is, whether it's an alien or a bird or a politician with many faces, that the debate hardly matters. What is undeniable is that over time, the work has gradually seeped into public consciousness as a woman's head and it universally referred to in the feminine gender. Chicago has grown accustomed to her face. I think that's really true. Have you heard from people who would argue that point with you after reading your book? Go, come on, it's not a woman.
Well, the people that have read my book.
Yes, they difficult to argue with you.
Because I illustrate it with different images leading up to it. Some of the precursors, he's even titled Jacqueline. So I think it's not just a woman, but it was his wife.
His wife.
And the woman he spent the last 10 years of his life with.
Yeah.
And as was his custom, the woman with whom he was involved became his
subject.
Muse.
Oh, no question.
And was in all his works of art during the period.
Yeah.
And in 1963, the year our Chicago architects went to visit him, he had been married to Jacqueline 2 years. He had known her maybe 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
He'd painted 160 paintings of her that year. That's almost one every other day.
Yeah.
So he was absorbed with this subject. So it seems like it would be unusual for him to break out and do something other than a portrait of her for this monumental piece that he had always longed to do.
You now believe, and I'm sure you'll hear this Tuesday at the Harold Washington Library from people in the crowd and from the people with whom you're sharing the stage, that I have grown incredibly fond of this creation, and one of the reasons being that it interacts with human beings. And I think that is a crucial element of its design, whether Picasso, do you think Picasso intended that? I do know from your book that originally there was going to be a fence around it. Remember?
That's what...
I'm asking you if you remember, yeah.
Well, Colonel O'Reilly, who staged the parades
event in the history of Chicago, yeah.
So he wanted to have this blocked off. He didn't really like having the sculpture there at all because it interfered with his performers and his bands and everything. But then he wanted a fence around it. And the architects did not design the plaza to have this fence.
Mm-hmm.
And Picasso did not like the fence at all. He said, I want the children to play on it. I want people to touch it. And then there's the base is 17 inches off the ground.
Yeah.
It's perfect for sitting. He wanted people to have their lunch there, to have a Coke, to have a cup of coffee. He had given up cigarettes, so he wasn't talking about them having a smoke, but he that would have been okay too.
Yeah, I think that was a brilliant idea of his. And I think in many ways, Mike Royko wrote a famous, Mike Royko, who was there on the unveiling with, he was there with Studs and wrote a remarkable column about the thing reflecting some of the harsher aspects of the city. And I think, even though Mike's column is brilliant, that as I said at the end of my piece, I have grown incredibly fond of that piece of sculpture, and especially because of the way you see a little kid sliding down that one section, and you can see it, ladies and gentlemen, any day you choose to walk into Daley Plaza. And it is just such a vibrant part of the city.
It was hard to get new photographs of it I had hired two different photographers locally.
Yeah.
They had a hard time getting a picture of the sculpture without children on it.
At 3 a.m., yeah.
They're always there.
Yeah, I know. That's the genius of it. And you too, Patricia Balton Stratton, you have done a remarkable thing for the city of Chicago by detailing as thoroughly as it will ever be done the story of the Chicago Picasso. The book is called The Chicago Picasso, A Point of Departure. It can be had at any bookstore in this town. It can be had on Amazon. It can be had on any way you think to get books. A really great way would be to go hear Patricia and a bunch of pals talk about the Picasso at 6 o'clock at the Harold Washington Library. It is a free event. It starts at 6, so get there a little early. On your way there, walk by the Picasso, or on your way home. I think that would only be fitting. It is great to meet you in person. I hope there's another book in you. How about those other two statues on Dearborn?
I don't know. I like the flamingo. It's probably my second favorite sculpture Chicago.
That will be my second favorite book about Chicago sculpture, because this is my favorite. It's lovely to meet you. Thanks for coming in. And
thank you so much
for orchestrating this, and have fun Tuesday. That ought to be, and sell a lot of books. There will be books there, and it is the most reasonably priced fine art book I've ever encountered at $25. Unbelievable. Patricia Balton Stratton, keep writing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The hour's over. Went so fast.